Today on Off Mic, the unrest nationwide and call for police reform sparked by the killing of George Floyd are the topics for today's show. Lakeshore Public Media hosted an online conversation this week called Race and Justice Here and Now. We bring six Northwest Indiana leaders together for dialogue and better understanding. We hope you enjoy listening to this important discussion. On Lakeshore Public Radio and reporter with WBEZ Radio in Chicago. Tonight's conversation is sparked by the death of George Floyd of Minneapolis 2 weeks ago at the hands of four police officers. George Floyd was laid to rest earlier today in his native Houston. Over the course of the last 2 weeks, there have been protests, demonstrations all over the country and right here in Northwest Indiana. A common call by demonstrators is for more police accountability, police reform, including perhaps defunding of police departments, and an end to Black men dying at the hands of police. Joining me in today's conversation are Indiana State Senator and longtime defense attorney Lonnie Randolph of East Chicago, Dr. Vanessa Allen McLeod, President and CEO of the Urban League of Northwest Indiana, Laurel Kilpatrick, organizer of Black Lives Matter Northwest Indiana, Gary, Frank Mervan, North Township trustee and Indiana first congressional Democratic primary winner, and former Lake County Sheriff and defense attorney Roy Dominguez, and Reverend Dr. John E. Jackson Sr., senior pastor of Trinity United Church of Christ in Gary. Thank you everyone for joining me here today. And for those of you watching on Facebook, you may submit questions. So we're going to get to the conversation. We hope to have a lot of dialogue and good conversation, ideas, and helpful debate. Laurel, let's start off with you. You've been at the center of so many of these protests locally over the last week or so. What is different about this latest call for police accountability?
Honestly, I don't think there's anything different about it. I think the fact that we've had so many deaths that not only have come about as a direct result of the police, but also overall the system. And I, for me, and if you speak to someone else, you may get a different answer. But for me, there is not that much different. Some people may say, well, the person who was killed this time was handcuffed and the police seem to be very nonchalant about it. But to me, a lost life is a lost life, and it happens much too often. So I can't speak for anyone else, but for myself, this is another tragic incident in a long, long list of tragic incidents that happen every day that are happening right now as we're having this conversation.
Well, let me ask you this. Are you surprised that not just at that there are protests here for George Floyd and for police accountability here in Northwest Indiana, but that they have been sustained and in so many different locations in Northwest Indiana?
I'm not that surprised. And the reason, one of the reasons why I think they've been sustained is because of the vicious pushback against what's supposed to be a right that everyone has. So even though people have come together for a particular issue, a particular death, or at least a death that happened at this particular time, I think the responses to people coming together, to people banding together in opposition to this brutal death, has caused its own wave of pushback action.
Dr. Vanessa Allen McLeod, head of the Urban League of Northwest Indiana, how much pain are you hearing about in Northwest Indiana from what happened to George Floyd?
Our community, thank you, Michael. Our community has been shaken. The whole nation has been shaken by this senseless death. You know, it's tragic. You know, we continue to see this, you know, outcry of grief and anger over years and years. It's not just with George Floyd, but with so many other senseless deaths. So, you know, we keep seeing it. And so it's very traumatic to all of us in this community.
Indiana State Senator Lonnie Randolph, you've seen movements in the past for civil rights. You've been a part of them and you've commented on them over the time and over the years in the Indiana State Senate. Is holding police accountability a civil right?
Well, I mean, at first blush, one would think that it's not. But when you can think about it and everything, considering historically what's been happening with the police, particularly in reference to how the relationship that existed between the police, the authorities, as well as the minority community, particularly African-Americans, it should be at that level at this point in time. That's the kind of attention it should be getting, and it has not been getting that kind of attention. I think that with what's been happening recently because of the mass protests that's been going on, not just in this country, but worldwide, that in itself should make it an argument that maybe it should be considered a civil right, okay? Based on what's been going on, these kind of instances happen on a regular basis with regularity in the minority community, particularly with African Americans and Hispanic community. And it's never been recognized. It's been unnoticed because when people complain about police mistreatment, it's never heard about it. People don't pay any attention to it. It's not recognized at all. It's not brought to the attention. News media, radio, nothing at all. But it had to take something of this nature to bring it and reveal it to the rest of the world. Now the whole world realized that, hey, this has been going on. And it's been happening to us for decades. It didn't just happen yesterday or last week or last year or 10 years ago. It's been happening for decades. Okay? And you can imagine how it used to be in the early 19th century, especially at the end of the 18th century when it was born, when slavery was just being to the point being abolished based upon Lincoln and Emancipation Proclamation and all those kind of things that was going on at that time. But this is a very serious thing that's been affecting us as a community. And it's been something that we've been focusing on that prevent us from doing the things that a normal, everyday, average family should be doing. They talk about white privilege. There is white privilege been existing for a long time. It's just that now we're starting to pay attention to it because of the exposure that's been going on and how the basic fundamental things that they've taken for granted that we have been abused by it based upon the authorities. We're affected in so many different ways. We're affected health-wise. We're affected environmental-wise. We're affected family-wise. We're affected growth-wise. We're affected development-wise in terms of our kids and families. So we've been affected so many ways by this discriminatory effect that's been happening on us. When Al Sharpton talked a few days about put on a neck. Well, that's been existing for a long time. And so that's why I tell my people, African Americans, they should be very proud. For years and decades, the foot has been on our neck. But look around. In spite of that, we move forward. So that should give some pride in us saying how resilient we are as a people. And hopefully, from this point on, the pride in young people hopefully will take effect. Because young people is not.
Okay, Senator, we're just going to get one more in there. Your mic is breaking up a little bit, but hopefully we can take care of that.
We're just starting to bring it out. We're trying to educate them, but it's kind of difficult for families to educate the young kids because they're trying to sustain themselves. They're living and provide for themselves. We're going to put on the table with the kids. We haven't had a chance. And I'm talking too much, I know that. But in any event, it's an issue that is deeply ingrained in me as an individual because I've experienced it. I recall one time I first went to college. I was in Marquette, Michigan, Northern Michigan University, and I was with two African Americans.
All right, Senator, thank you. Thank you. We're going to move on with the conversation now. This is Lakeshore Public Media's conversation with race and justice here and now. We're going to be going on to our next panelist. Is he still talking? All right, Senator, thank you. We're going to be going on to our next panelist. here on Lakeshore Public Media's conversation, Race and Justice Here and Now. Roy Dominguez, you've been at the helm of a large police force as the former sheriff of Lake County. Do you believe police agencies right now discussing the situation of what happened to George Floyd? And if you were the sheriff right now, would you be discussing it with your officers on how to avoid killing an individual that's in your custody?
Absolutely, I would. And it should be a concern for everybody. I mean, we should look at the positive excessive force. I guess I would look internally and do that first of all. And then second of all, I would call all the police chiefs in Northwest Indiana together and say, let's look at it together. Because when you do it together, then you can have a bigger impact on how police work and making sure that the force necessary to effect an arrest is not abused. And that when officers do abuse that necessary steps are taken either to remove him or her from the police department, criminal charges are filed, and also to make sure that other officers who witness it don't just go what commonly referred to as a code blue silence. We cannot have silence in things of this nature. It must be discussed openly, must be done aggressively to protect lives. And that's the role of the police chiefs, the sheriffs, and everybody involved to make sure that the policies in any police agency is respectful and make sure that we protect lives. And that's what police officers should do. This should never have happened. And my prayers and sentiments to George Floyd, his family, to everybody. And I'm really happy about what's going on. And I'm really happy about the discussion that we're having because it is long overdue, but not only in police work, but in many other areas in the criminal justice system. When people become defendants and are sentenced, making sure that our sentencing procedures are not biased against minorities and others, and making sure that the system is fair and that the world is a kinder and gentler place for all of us.
Thank you. And our next panelist, Frank Mervan, North Township Trustee. You're going to be probably heading to Washington, D.C. Come in January, pending your a win in the general election. So welcome to the conversation. But what role do you see the national government playing in local police agencies? Is there a role here to play for the federal government in trying to hold local police departments accountable?
First, thank you very much, Michael, in allowing me to be here. Second, we're going to work hard through November, and there is no foregone conclusion as the nominee. My perspective would be to, first and foremost, make sure that the communities that I represent that are hurting based on the injustice that has gone on. I want to always talk about peace and bringing people together. I had the opportunity to meet with some ministers. I was at the Gary rally on Sunday, and Saturday we were in Hammond. And ultimately, I think that the message is that peacefully we have to bring change. No longer is there patience for injustice. And so to directly answer your question on what the federal government can do specifically to policing, there are measures that are moving forward with the Justice in Policing Act that would establish a national police misconduct database. It would ban chokeholds. It would also end racial profiling. And so those are some steps that the federal government is looking at as far as moving legislation currently. And so there is a role in the federal government because for too long we have witnessed situations like this. And, you know, I also want to say that in experience with being at the rallies, 98% of the police force are men and women who want to do the right thing. And the injustice of what happened in Minnesota with George Floyd is something that no one wants to tolerate and accept as a practice in our nation. So as I am preparing to get through the November general election to become a member of Congress, it's with that I take the message back that we've got to be able to find justice and we also have to be able to protect our communities and find a fair balance. And so I brought those three points up because those are measures that are moving forward. And I believe that these types of forums and having communications and bringing this to light and continuously showing up and being present and understanding is vital to a member of Congress or someone who's asking to be that in Northwest Indiana and in the country.
Thank you. Reverend Dr. Johnny Jackson, Sr., what role does the faith community play in trying to heal the community from this?
The faith community has a essential role in helping to heal the community. First of all, faith community, in particular, we talk about the Black church, has a very pivotal role in affirming the anger of people. When injustice as cruel, as heinous, and as dastardly as this one has been committed, and this is just a tip of the iceberg of so many others, anger is appropriate, and the faith community needs to affirm that in the community, that anger is appropriate. The healing process takes anger. Any psychologist or psychiatrist will say that you have to allow the anger to run its course, but don't try to stop the anger too soon, or you will pile on grief, which will come out in other ways and destructive ways. So first of all, anger is appropriate. Second, acquiescence is not acceptable. So oftentimes you hear when these things happen with Black folk that there are people who run out and they want to try to share with in particular the immediate family and then others around them and then the community, calm down, you know, bring your anger down, you know, let's be more congenial and peaceful and all that, and you end up hindering the healing process, and it flows into an acquiescence of the situation that caused it in the first place. And so then you look up and you're facing another situation. And so finally, the faith community can then help folk recognize that action activism is a part of the healing process. So everybody can't do the same thing, but everybody can do something in order to help alleviate the causes of this criminal behavior by some folk in law enforcement and in other places. And so while some folk are going to protest, Laurel and others, Black Lives Matter, I'm so proud of them because they're keeping the fire burning, keeping the attention on and going all over the world. That is essential. But then other folk can do things to help elected officials and pastors, hold them accountable so that there are ways to help minister to the community, to help organize the community, to letter writing campaigns and putting platforms to elected officials that you've got to hold to these platforms no matter how it goes against the grain of the system, because we're thinking about people more than the system. So the faith community, in particular the Black church, is essential because the Black church has been the birthplace of activism from the slave uprisings. The Black church was the way station on the Underground Railroad to the Civil Rights Movement. The organizing spaces were the Black church had the pivotal role.
Well, you're listening to Lakeshore Public Media's Community Conversation on Race and Justice Here and Now. I'm Michael Puente, host of Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio and reporter with WBEZ Radio in Chicago. My next question, again, going back to Laurel Kirkpatrick, organizer of Black Lives Matter, Northwest Indiana, Gary. Laurel, a lot of the discussion right now here in Northwest Indiana and nationally is this idea of defunding police departments. What can you explain to the folks here listening online, looking at TV, and those online, if you have a question, you can submit it and we'll try to read it during our conversation. But Laurel, explain that to us. What would defunding look like? And that might mean communities being without police protection.
So I think a lot of what it looks like, well, depending on where you are, depending on the role, that the police more often plays than not. One of the ways it could look is that people in communities, sometimes the only course of action that some people have, some people don't have the option to call the police, maybe because of someone who lives in their household, maybe because of an issue that they're having. They don't have the option of, maybe because of the history of the particular police in their area, calling the police is not an option. So what people are already doing is relying on the community, relying on the people around them, relying on their family members, their distant family members, to respond to emergencies that they're having, regardless of what those emergencies are. So I think this is one of those questions that, however many people that you ask who are involved in this situation, you're going to get that many different answers. But I think that one thing that it solidly means is we have to look not at the role that the police is supposed to play, but we have to look at the reality of the role that more often than not police play for people who live in these communities that are most at risk of being taken advantage of. But most immediately, it means relying on those networks that people already rely on to help them in whatever situation that they're having. That's the easy of it.
What's the heart of it? What's the heart of it?
There's a little bit more.
If I may. Again, I'm interested. Yeah. Give me the hard part.
We lost our host.
Did we lose Mike?
Dr. McLeod, you're in. You're the person with the PhD.
Oh, listen.
There it is. There we go.
There he is. He's back with us.
You're muted.
For a moment there.
Okay, you're back. We're back there now. I have deleted technical difficulty. Those storms out there.
Yes, it happens.
Gremlins or something is working out over here. So let me get back to our conversation and thank you everybody for bearing with us. Lonnie Randolph, again, when you see some of the struggles that are happening today with George Floyd, as shocking as it is, are you surprised that with everything you've seen over your decades in politics and activism, that this continues to happen? And where do you draw the line in that it just cannot continue to happen? What do you do?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, I think the line is being drawn now. The very fact that it's been exposed in terms of how African-Americans have been treated in their communities by the authorities is being exposed now. So maybe because of the awareness that's being made to the whole world, to whites, other Hispanics, to other races, the other groups, professional organizations, maybe now the line is being drawn to the point where something affirmative will be done about it. And I'm very hopeful that it might occur in everything. For a long time, I've been striving to try to make the public aware of some of the inadequacies that's been placed upon the minority communities. But it's been very difficult, long road. And I'm happy to see it coming about now. I'm happy to see up with our future congressperson, Mr. Mervan, here to hear these things. So when he goes to Washington and starts looking at bills, maybe he'll start thinking about how they're going to affect the minority community, particularly African Americans. He's had experience with the minority community anyway, but in terms of with legislation and how it might affect them in their everyday lives, I think they'll be beneficial to him. So when laws come across his desk and he can analyze them, he'll be thinking about how it affects not just one particular race, but all race, all the people that he represents and everything. So I'm wishing him good luck. And I'm going to be supportive of him in terms of those measures. And if he's not doing what I think is appropriate in terms of affecting the community as a whole, yeah, I'm going to let him know about that as well. Okay. But I'm glad to see he's here. And last time he and I talked, I didn't get a chance to congratulate him on his Democratic nomination for the congressional position.
Dr. McLeod, so much of what you do as the Urban League, you form partnerships, and I got to assume over the years some of those partnerships have been with police agencies and trying to create dialogue and understanding and trust. over the past 2 weeks, has a lot of that been lost? And if it has, how do you reconnect it?
Well, Michael, in some instances, yes, it's been lost. Whenever you witness on national TV a policeman with his knee on the neck of a human being, George Floyd, when you watch some of the news accounts of videos that have surfaced where police are shooting people with the taser or with their batons. You know, we're seeing it over and over again, and particularly with a white policeman against African-American population. So we need a comprehensive plan for community policing and for trust and for conversations. Yes, with the Urban League, we have had several diversity and inclusion symposiums, and we've talked about the importance of having policing, police review boards. The National Urban League put out a 10-point police reform and accountability plan. This was back in 2014. Just recently, the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus had some recommendations for reform. And mostly we're all saying the same thing. We want those police to have statewide use of body and dashboard cameras. We want some type of anti-racial profiling law. There's a number of things that are similar in all of these plans. I think what the problem is we have not enforced it, and we have not pushed for that type of accountability. However, with all of the demonstrations that are going on throughout the entire world, especially with the Black Lives Matter leading most of this, I have never witnessed such demonstrations before in my lifetime. I believe I was a child when Dr. Martin Luther King had his march, and my mom took me there. But this is something that we're seeing all over the world, and I believe the change is going to happen because we're not letting up when you see something like that. And we have to continue to dialogue. I like the saying that, well, all police aren't bad. That's true. And all Black people aren't bad. That's true. But when you visibly, when you're watching national TV and you see something like this over and over and over, I can start naming names of all of the African-American people who've been killed by the police and no indictments. So I do hope that we continue this push. I'm very much in support of the protest, but I'm also in support of having some dialogue with the police so that we can talk about training and we can talk about sensitivity training and how you can have conflict resolution. So that's my thought on it. And Urban League will continue to, you know, just point out those injustices as we see them.
Thank you. Reverend Jackson, you mentioned earlier about the pain and the anger many are feeling, perhaps in your congregation. How are you addressing that among people? Is the anger real? Is it justified? But how do you turn that anger into action? How do you get over that anger so something positive comes from it?
So as I was saying, anger is real. When you look at this, this is historical. Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois in 1903, in his book, The Souls of Black Folk, the most prolific line in his book was, "The problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line."
That's right.
And in mathematics, when you don't solve a problem, you still have a problem. And the problem of the 21st century is the color line. And so we have generations of people of African ancestry who know viscerally the hate that is in this country. Not from everybody, but it is a part of the very foundation of the country. Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution. Black people, African slaves, were considered 3/5 of human. So the anger is real. The anger is historical. And the anger is systemic. And so one of the things we're trying to do is help folk understand that the anger, don't let it go. Keep the anger, utilize it in some of these organizations, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's the Urban League, whether it is Movement for Black Lives. There are a number of organizations that I have introduced people to that they can begin to plug into, because these organizations have been doing work on the ground for a long time, and now they need support. Because what Dr. King died trying to create was a beloved community that went against the status quo of capitalistic mindsets, where you have some people on the top and a bunch of people on the bottom, mm-hmm. so that a beloved community is a community where everybody has enough. And that means we have to do something about the value. I'm also a former police officer out of Chicago. And so when we talk about reform, we also got to talk about people coming to a police department with certain mindset that they're not going to walk onto the police department and say, I'm a racist and I want to bust some heads to some black folks. We've got to go deeper than that. And Camden, New Jersey is an example, because they fired all the police officers. Then they had them rehired. You got to re-interview. And they did some things to try to weed out folk who come to the department with these mindsets that black people are inherently bad. They have to be controlled. They have to be policed more than white communities, even though we know that black and white communities use drugs at the same level, have violence at the same level, but the black communities get policed harder than the white community. That's the mindset. That's systemic. And so I educate my congregation and then try to help them see that we as a congregation are going to do some things beyond the walls of the church. And then there are these wonderful organizations that are doing great work that need support. And when we engage, we are doing something to build a beloved community where everybody is valued, everybody is whole, and everybody has enough of what they need.
And if I can follow up on what Dr. Reverend was talking about in terms of that, when these police officers come to force, you've got to have a good heart. Good heart means that you want to do what's good, what's in the best interest of the community by doing your job. And so that's where screening comes in there. So we have not been paying enough attention to the screening aspect of it, because so many officers, when they come as potential candidates to be a police officer, because they're going to have police powers, they come in with this mentality that they are untouchable. They can do anything they want. That's why if the screening is not correct in terms of getting the character of the individual coming in and the heart is not there, you're going to put the wrong people in the wrong positions and positions of authority where they're going to abuse the authority. And the other problem, too, is once they get on that force and you discover how they are, the supervisors, sergeants, lieutenants, captains, they don't have, in the past, have not had enough courage to be able to weed them out and get rid of them. Now, with a screening process, which is one of the things that Blackhawks is recommending, localized as well as statewide, maybe that screening process will force them to be a little bit more diligent in the responsibilities of screening people out. And when they do see wrong going on, they'll do something about it. That's why part of our agenda that we have as a Black Caucus is whistleblowers. We're looking at a whistleblower law. So if, in fact, you've got an officer on the force like these four that just happened with Mr. Floyd, and if they see you doing wrong, they can do whatever they can to go and bring it to the attention of the appropriate people without being feel that they're going to be retaliated against. So that's one of the things, too, that we're looking at as a caucus and everything.
Roy Dominguez, you as the former Lake County Sheriff, you've had to balance diversity and inclusion within the ranks of your police department there. We were just seeing in Crown Point the hiring of the first African-American police officer in Crown Point, and Maryville has just hired their first African-American police chief. But is it as simple as bringing more diversity to a police force? Sometimes a minority police officer can be just as hard on his own community as a white officer. How do you balance that? And how do you bring in diversity to police agencies, is that still important?
Screening diversity is very important. Very important. I was always very mindful of that. And also not only in race, but in gender and in different backgrounds. because we, the police department, are representative of the community. I'd like to say that as we continue this dialogue, that those that they also need loving is also the police officers. Just because you have these police officers who are doing these things is not representative of all of the police officers. Many of the police officers want to do a great job and want to be public servants and protect our community. So as we see them, we should not feel that they are the bad guys, because they're not. They're not. We need to identify those that are not providing consistent professional police work, protecting lives. At the onset, screening is critical. When I was sheriff, we instituted, not only were they healthy, not only did they pass the test, but could they pass a psychological test? And if they can't pass a psychological test, that's where you look as to see whether or not people have the right sensitivity to become police officers. Now, here's the one that's really, really difficult. And I can speak to this firsthand, that we would hire people, and then maybe within a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, they turn into this culture that isn't the reason we hired you. But yet there are so many rules and regulations to try to either discipline them, try to remove them, becomes very difficult. So all we could do is put them in different positions where they didn't come in contact with the public because they did not police professionally. They didn't do the right thing. It's the culture within the police department that somehow, if you look at what happened with George Floyd, the officer who was charged with murder was a training officer. Here's a guy who has, according to the report, had 18 or so different police write-ups and disciplinary actions against him and complaints against him. Why would this person be a trainer? He should never have been a trainer, let alone to these three officers who were on the job for 4 days. Where do they learn this? Because these officers might have been screened properly, but yet you got a guy like this officer saying, here's how we do it. Well, that's not how you do it. And that's where the heart is, where we've got to make sure that everybody, police administrators, the community, that those people with that mindset are either removed from the police department or taken away from any responsibility of training our new officers.
Thank you, Mr. Dominguez. Frank Mervan, you are one step away from representing Northwest Indiana in Congress. That's going to hold a lot of power. In your conversations, in your dealings with the community now as North Township trustee, since this event has happened, is there one or two issues that you would introduce on the House floor now? If you have that power now to introduce a bill, one thing that maybe can help with all this, what's that one idea that you think could possibly alleviate or hold police more accountable to their community? Is there an idea that you've heard so far?
Sure. So the question is, you know, where will I stand as a member of Congress? And I don't know if there is one piece of legislation that's going to be the magic pill that cures everything. So I do want to touch upon my experiences of being a North Township trustee and how we engaged with the police departments that I think is vital. We hired, or we brought in our social work team from IU Northwest. And what we did is we had a program which is called 13 Reasons Why Not that we went into the high schools. But we also developed and we worked with the Highland, Griffith, and Munster Police Departments. And we put on a symposium about, at one point, there was a high suicide rate going on with policemen. That was in the beginning of last year. And the National Association of Chiefs talked about how we have to be able to have access to mental health for policemen. So my office put on a symposium about the reality of suicides. If someone talks to you about having dangerous thoughts of harming themselves, how you react. And what I discovered within that was that there isn't a lot of mental health access to policemen who face PTSD based on experiences that they have as policemen. Because let's face it, day in and day out, they see a lot of things that no one else wants to see. And there's a lot of trauma, and PTSD is real. And they felt that there was a stigma that would follow the policeman if they came forward to their police, to their supervisors, and they would not have the ability to get the help that they needed or discuss that because it would be signs of weakness, and they felt that they potentially could be categorized as unfit for the job. And so there was a great deal of apprehension to be able to have access to mental health. So in the overall, what I'm talking about is when we talk about community policing and then really having engagement with the community, the faith-based community, absolutely number one, you have to have policemen in the faith-based community working together and all communities. But you, what else we did at the township, which will have a role when I go to Congress, is we put together a rapid response team that, so policemen are not social workers either. And so they would refer cases to us from East Chicago, Highland, Munster, Whiting, of domestic violence or of addiction that our social work team would work with and find results for community members who had a police call and did not have a solution. The current sheriff has adopted that program also, victim advocates with social work teams. So those are the types of things in community policing that absolutely make a difference. So, you know, you talked about day one, what are we going to look for? Because this issue is absolutely going to carry over, and no one should wait for solutions. People, you know, we have inspired patience for injustice. And you know, when we talk about that, like I mentioned, banning chokeholds, ending racial profiling, establishing a national, you know, police misconduct. And what that would do is it would be able to not be, it would be enable us to be able to understand what communities need to reform the most based on police misconduct in those communities throughout the nation. And those types of measures would absolutely contribute to that. But our, you know, I don't want to talk in broad scopes. Those are things that I would look at. But our community policing and the ability to understand that there is no one magic pill. A United States congressman is going to be able to say this is the answer. And I think all of us agree from the different perspectives that we bring that it's going to take a lot of healing. It's going to take a lot of effort to be able to get to the place of peace, harmony, and justice for all. And we also have to talk about the faith-based community. As I mentioned, I just sat down with them today. And Pastor Jackson mentioned the fact that there's anger. Well, one of the initiatives is angry enough to vote, making sure that we are doing everything we can from every walk of life, that people are registered, people who have been purged off the rolls, access to voting rights, that we do everything we can moving forward, that when we talk about elected officials being held accountable, the first way you do that is by voting. And so those initiatives, I believe, are going to continue to escalate because the people on local and state and federal levels who are responsible for the policies going forward, we have to have more than 23% of the voting population making those decisions. So the escalation of or the ability to utilize this as giving a right or a power to people. In this last election, there was an increase in younger voters who came out. And so that's a good thing. That's a good thing that people want to be engaged. And I think all of that combined is, and being present as a member of Congress. Senator Randolph said, being present, hearing these conversations, and knowing for a fact, because I realize it on an economic level, but knowing legislation impacts real people's lives.
Thank you. We have about 20 more minutes to Lakeshore Public Media's Community Conversation, Race and Justice, Here and Now. I'm Michael Puente, host of Off Mic here on Lakeshore Public Radio and reporter with WBEZ Chicago. Laura, let me ask you this. You've been involved now in protests from Gary to other parts of Northwest Indiana. How have you been received in some of the more white areas of Northwest Indiana? And you feel like your message is getting across.
So I just want to clear up one thing that I heard mentioned, that I don't remember who mentioned it, about Black Lives Matter being at the root of a lot of these actions that are happening in this area, and that's not so. And the reason why I like to be sure to make that point is because you don't have to be in an organization like Black Lives Matter to know that there is something tremendously wrong, not just with policing, but I think with the overall power structure of our society. I mean, we see people now standing up and being extremely vocal globally. But just talking about here locally, it's not Black Lives Matter that's standing behind and encouraging people to hit the streets. As a matter of fact, the action that just happened in Hammond, Black Lives Matter people were invited to that, right? A lot of people left initially the action when these young people took to the street. So it's I think we have to give a wider scope of credit for people knowing and always having known that something is wrong. Something is wrong, and they're taking action. Another thing, and Michael, I'm gonna ask you just briefly restate the question. Another thing that I wanted to say really quickly, when we look at the history of oppression in this country we all know, well, not everybody, but most people should know that this country was formed on the basis of oppression. This country was formed on the basis of taking advantage. Right. And so we have the origins of the police in one area of this country was based on the continued inhumane subjugation of African people, period. That is the evolution of the modern police force in the South. In the North, it's almost the exact origin, but instead from a European immigrant perspective, being the people that needed to be kept underfoot. Right. Being the people that needed to be dominated, and that domination being funded by a ruling class with money who had social norms and interests that they wanted to protect. So when people say things like not all cops are bad or only a few cops are the bad ones, most of them are good. If good cops are not stopping bad cops, they're bad. I don't have time to try to sift through who the nice ones are and who aren't. As far as I'm concerned, there's an integral part of that job that says you're supposed to stop people who break the law. That includes somebody who might be wearing a uniform. Okay, I'll stop there with that. Mike, can you briefly restate your question? I promise I'll answer it quickly.
No, fine. And listen, we are heading into the last 10 minutes of our program.
Gotcha.
All the panelists to try to keep your answers short. But I wanted to ask you, Laurel, in some of the demonstrations that you've been a part of, either through Black Lives Matter or just going out there on your own, how have you been received in some of the, say, the more angle areas of our county? What are some of the dialogue you've been having with folks, say, in Griffith, Schererville, St. John, which may not be accustomed to seeing some of these demonstrations and or large groups of Black people?
So I'll give a perfect example. I'm from East Chicago, Indiana. Right next to East Chicago is Whiting. Whiting, for a long time, and I think just about everybody knows if you're from this area, is an extremely hostile place, right? In terms of the racism shown by people, not all people, but enough people, that if you're from East Chicago, you know where you go and where you don't go. That's my personal experience being a native of East Chicago. The event that I went to in Whiting was, I don't want to say inspiring, but for me, I will say surprising. It was surprising the degree of anti-racist sentiment that came out of that action of the people who lived in Whiting, the people who came out and wanted to be counted as a not racist person, because when the younger folks who put together that action had these conversations online, they were threatened. They were threatened with violence. Their lives were threatened, right? All of this happened. But the community of the people in Whiting who were not racist, who believed and understood that racism is very real and reaches to every aspect in our society and wanted to be counted as people who stood up against that. I think that's one of the more memorable aspects to all of these actions that are happening, and that you have an area, again, that's known for its hostility, where you have people who came out, about 200 or more people. I stopped counting at that. More than 200 people came out. We marched from the park all the way to City Hall. And people came out of their houses. So people who didn't start off with us at the park came out of their houses and joined that rally. Of course, you had people, you know, who were around. You had people who were making racist comments. You had people who online was threatening people's lives. And I doubt anything happened to them. But, you know, that's how it is sometimes. But the tremendous amount of people who made themselves known, it was amazing. So that's something that stands out in my mind. In terms of that particular thing that you're talking about, people who came out, people who showed up.
You know, probably my final question, I'm going to have this for the entire panel, and you can kind of draw upon it, but we're kind of nearing the end of our program, last 10 minutes. And I'll start with Reverend Jackson. What are you going to be doing in the next week or so? In either talking to your congregation or people close to you to remind people of what still needs to be done and that George Floyd doesn't become, you know, part of the news cycle and forgotten in a couple of days. What still needs to be done in your estimation to keep this conversation going for real change, for real change in police departments? What needs to be done, Reverend Jackson?
So I'm going to do what I continue to do. So for me, my ministry has been dealing with oppressed people and helping to oppress people see they have agency to overthrow, overcome the oppression that they face. So it's a consistency that for me, this person, I'm not saying all pastors do have done that. But I know for me, it's a continuation and it is a validation because oftentimes we fall asleep, we get comfortable. We think that things are pretty much okay. There's a little bit of racism here, but it's not that bad. And then these instances come up that shocks us because we fall asleep. We think we elected the first black president. Things are pretty good. We in post-racial. Well, we find out that no, we're not in post-racial. There are some very racist people, and they are a significant part of the society as seen by the election of COVID-45. So we're facing a situation where the president and Mr. Mervan got to deal with it, who is not the leader of it. He's just riding a wave of what was undercurrent anyway. And so it is reminding folks that this moment, I call it a Kairos moment. All over the world, Kairos moment, God's moment, God's time, Kairos. All over the world, from New Zealand to Zimbabwe, from Germany to London to Paris to Central South America, there are protests and murals of George Floyd and protests going on in solidarity with African Americans in particular and the fight for justice in general in this country. That's a moment that I am trying to fan the flame in my congregation and others that I encounter. That we can't go back to the normal. The normal shows us there was some grave inequities in this society. From COVID showed us that when black folk are dying more than other folk from COVID, not because COVID-19 is a respecter of person, but because of the inequity. And so we've got to grasp this moment to not go back to the old normal, but create a new normal where we do things differently, that we put people's lives over profit, that we put meaning over money.
Thank you, Reverend. We've got about literally like 4 minutes to go, so I want to make sure everybody has one last thing to say. Keep it at maybe 20 to 30 seconds. So we're like on that 2 minute shot clock. Dr. McLeod, what in your estimation still needs to be done?
We're going to continue our conversations and facilitating dialogue with organizations and agencies and our other community partners to have these courageous conversations on race and equality and equity, and to just talk about what's happening now and how they're feeling. We have to keep this in front, and especially my partners who are white, the white community. We need the white community to stand up as the allies that they are, you know, and support what we're doing. And we need to have those conversations. We need to talk about those conversations and make sure that people understand our pain, are hurt, are suffering, and then we want to hear from them. We want to talk about white privilege. We want to share some information with everyone on some resources that can maybe promote dialogues and conversations. That's what the Urban League is going to continue to do. Thank you, Michael.
Senator Randolph, 20 to 30 seconds, what still needs to be done?
Yeah, thank you, Mike. I appreciate the opportunity. I don't want us to lose sight on the focal point, because Frank had indicated earlier about reformation in terms of the community. The focal point has to be on reforming the police department, not just because of racism, but because of the abuse of power that they have. So that's the focal point. When you talk about reformation, the community being reformed will be based upon the reformation of the police department concerning them being an avenue, an agency that's going to be working on behalf of the community. Once you do that, then the community is automatically going to start changing because of the reaction that they're going to have based upon the relationship that's created because of that reformation that happens with the police department. So my application will be consistently toward advocating toward the focal point on reforming the police department.
Thank you, Senator. And Sheriff Dominguez, former Sheriff Dominguez, 20 seconds. What do police departments still have to do?
They must always be vigilant in making sure that their policies and procedures protect people, not abuse people. And for those officers who are not protecting people, they should be removed. And all of us on a personal nature should get out and vote. I can say on a personal note, we need to stand up. This last election, I stood up and I voted, and we got a great nominee coming up in November.
Thank you, everybody. I'm going to have to end it there. We come out of time. You were listening to Lakeshore Public Media's Community Conversation, Race and Justice Here and Now. I'm Michael Puente, and I want to thank all of our panelists, Indiana State Senator Lonnie Randolph, Dr. Vanessa Allen McLeod, President and CEO of the Urban League of Northwest Indiana, Laurel.
You muted yourself, Mike.
Can't hear you, Mike.
It's a pleasure to be an honor with all of y'all.
Yes, you can't hear us.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate the opportunity.
Appreciate.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
All right, adios.
Thank you.
All right.